Basically, it's summarized in the concept of you only go around once in life, so grab for all the gusto you can get. That's a popular commercial. Even McDonald's has a little line that summarizes this. You deserve a break today. There's a definite message from the world. Live for the moment. Second, our world is trying to teach us this concept. Live for the sensual. If it feels good, do it. By the way, let me make a statement here. If the majority of the Christians are doing it, it's probably wrong. God does not work in a democracy with spirituality. In fact, generally the minority are the ones who are right. How many were right of the 12 spies that went into Canaan? What percentage of the total was that? 16 2/3%. So if you look around the morality of the Christian community, what the average is probably wrong. It's not God's desire. Live for somebody. The song is old, but it still communicates the philosophy that our world has communicated to us. You're nobody till somebody loves you. And so we look at our dating life and we say, you know, my worth is really revolves around the person I'm dating, either he or she. And we evaluate our significance by the relationship we have, the dating relationship we have. And that's not right. We're talking this hour about healthy dating relationships. If your dating relationships have any of these three, it's unhealthy. Let me just start it right from the beginning. Now, we also have communicated that there are two basic philosophies in a relationship. The world's philosophy is where the guy and the girl are out to get. The guy is out to get physical intimacy, and the girl is out to get emotional commitment or emotional intimacy. They both want things. It's selfish. They want it for the self. However, in Christ, in healthy dating relationships, you have the potential to be free to give to each other, free to help one another, build up one another. Why? Because you're both focused on the Lordship of Christ. Different philosophies, radically different implications. As we have viewed navigator relationships over the past 14 years almost, we have noticed three patterns. And we would like to bring these out. I think they're in the book, but I'd like to explain them a little bit. Here's a pattern that often happens. This is called the never dater pattern. A person has been involved in worldly dating relationships. And then the person becomes a Christian right here. They're just appalled, just literally appalled at the way they've been practicing their date life. So then they go into a counter reaction or counter approach, and they go into no relationships at all. And eventually they decide, hey, I want to get married. And so all of a sudden they're engaged or serious. And we feel that that approach produces a distinctive Christian marriage with problems. Why? Because the dating foundation was cut off, was deficient. Here's another approach that we've seen in Navigator Ministries. A person has been involved in worldly dating relationships. And then they become a Christian right here. The only problem is, it does not affect their dating life. Oh, maybe they're a little less physical. But it really hasn't affected the values, the deep down inside values that motivate a person. And so what happens is that you have a marriage of two Christians with problems. Why? Because their values were never altered by the Lordship of Christ. This is the one that we suggest would be the ideal. person becomes a Christian here, and the Lord really doesn't get a hold of his dating relationship, so he has a period of worldly relationships. Or a person becomes a Christian here, and because he's appalled, or because he goes through a lordship decision, his past of worldly dating relationships is repulsed. And because they're repulsed and he wants to grab new principles to date by, there may be a period of time in which there are possibly no dating relationships. Now, we feel that's healthy. For most people, it's probably healthy for a short period of time. Then we would suggest that there need to be many healthy relationships. Underline many. This will probably produce a much better foundation for marriage and a much better success rate in the marriage relationship. Now, I want to explore this right here, this possibly no relationships. I asked a bunch of Glengangers here back last fall to come up with reasons why people don't date. And I took those reasons and put them together and summarized and added a few and deleted a few. And I'd like to share what the results are. What? Yes, you're free to ask questions anytime you want. Go ahead. I think that you could put in there friendships, under many healthy friendships. Well, yeah, I see your point. Your definition of dating is so important, and I'm just kind of going back and forth. You know, in our book we say a prearranged appointment between two members of the opposite sex. The world doesn't like that because it doesn't have the romantic in it. I don't feel you should have many serious or romantic dating relationships. But there ought to be a period of time where you don't have any. There should be a period of time where you don't have much romantic interest if you really want to get down to what the Lord has for you. And we're going to talk about good reasons for not dating as well as bad reasons. Okay, I don't want to take the time to go through this definition, but you're going to do it in one of your study guides. Have you done that yet? Defining a date? And that was in chapter 3. Healthy dating? Okay. But whether you include the word romantic or not makes a big difference on how you discuss the whole topic. And I kind of go back and forth. We kind of go back and forth. Ask if you don't know, okay? Our next hour is on progression, and I think that the next hour should deal with this and what we feel is a healthy progression in friendships and dating relationships. Okay, we have a whole hour on that, plus 26 questions that you all have submitted under that category.
I wonder, Greg, if for the purposes here.
Okay, I believe there's some good reasons for not dating. First of all, a person needs to dry out from a worldly dating pattern. And I think that's excellent. That's what I went through. Second, a person needs to determine principles of godly dating or relating. Another excellent reason. Third, he wants to focus on deepening his relationship with God. Now, some of you may have chosen not to date here at the LDI or at Glen Eyrie for reason one or two, but after after doing the post-seminar assignments, you should pretty much have your principles down, at least as much as you can get from our study guides. But you may choose still not to date, and probably this reason or reason four would be the reason why you don't date at Glenary or don't relate on a very deep level with members of the opposite sex. Number four, wants to concentrate on ministry. And this may not be a good reason, but it is a reason and applies exclusively to women. No one asks out. Poor reasons. Why are you giggling, Margot? Oh. Poor reasons not to date. First of all, there's a fear of what others might think or say. And I can really see that is a fear here at Glenary because of the grapevine, which I think is immature in this area. But nevertheless, it is a reason, poor as it may be. Second, fear of rejection and or failure. A number of the questions that came in related to what if I say I'm interested in pursuing a relationship and the other person doesn't respond the same way? What do I do? In other words, you've thrown out your transparency, you're vulnerable, and the person could chop your head off the block. Well, in Christianity, you have to be vulnerable, transparent, and there are going to be a lot of times when you're disappointed. But fear of failure or rejection is not a good reason not to date. Number three, they don't trust themselves, and I generally think of physical. I'm sorry? It's a good reason up to a point, particularly if you're trying to dry out. That would be a good reason be right here. Okay? But if it goes on too long and you don't deal with the problem, you've got to start dealing with the problem, the real issue. And avoidance is not the way of dealing with problems. That's why. He said it's not trusting God. Okay, number four. Philosophy of not dating unless you are serious. I have real problems with this one. I really do. Let me tell you why. We navigators are probably more guilty of that one than any other. Let's do a little bit of doctrine of sanctification overview, okay? Overview of the doctrine of sanctification in the Navigator movement. Now, this is very simple. This is a point of conversion, point of where you become a disciple maker, mature Christian. And of course, once you're mature, you keep pressing on. Here, a person is a non-Christian. We know, you and I know, that there are steps you take to help a person become a Christian, right? Natural steps. A person has to hear the gospel. He has to hear it clearly. And then he has to understand it. And then he has to know how to receive the gift that God offers him. Well, that's very simple. And then we've already had a couple seminars and follow-up, right? A person just doesn't go from convert to disciple. They're very legitimate, natural things you must do to help a person follow the lordship of Christ. You've got to teach him scripture, memory, quiet time, prayer, the importance of obedience, lordship, importance of the word, scripture, memory, and so on. Right? All of us would affirm to that. We get on our soapbox and preach it down at the corner. Right? Then once a person's a disciple, you've got to drive on. You've got to keep going. You've got to help him understand that, yeah, you just don't sin what you've got. You don't put your lamp under a bushel. You pass it on. You apply the Great Commission to your life. You make disciples. You are a steward of what you've been entrusted. And so there's a legitimate progression to the point where you have made disciples. And then from a disciple maker, there are legitimate things you got to deal with. Things like time management, personal life management, finances, dating, marriage, singleness. On and on and on. The list gets very long. This is a summary of what we do in the Navigators, right? This is an overview of our doctrine of sanctification. In dating, I'm just drawing a parallel. In dating, there is a similar type of progression where you start from friendship, you go to casual dating, serious dating, and this is where the romantic comes in. Romantic begins somewhere here. Then you end up engagement or marriage. At any point, you can get out of the progression. But there is a legitimate progression, right? And there are legitimate steps you must take that are just as practical to go from one step to the other. Once you're engaged, you're not married yet, you've got a major transition in your life when the two of you grow into one, so that at the point of marriage you are one in the flesh in the eyes of God. Now, what happens when a person adopts this philosophy? You're not a philosophy of not dating unless you are serious. They are saying that they can take a relationship from here to here without going through the steps. That's what I call the quantum leap approach to dating. Now, have you ever known a convert to go to disciple maker without going through a certain progression? I've never known one. And yet time and time and time again in Navigator Ministries, I've seen it from friendship to serious dating. And they leave out major significant foundations that they need to go through in that progression. Yeah.
How were these foundations established before dating became a cultural thing in the United States? Like in biblical times or even many non-cultures, non-dating cultures today?
Well, you had Hawk. They date in your culture?
Some do.
Okay. And Chu, do they date in your culture?
Or
just in the world's definition? Not really. How do they get married in your culture? Okay. In your culture, Hawk. How do they get married in your culture? Parents arrange it? Okay. Okay. Marisi, do they date in your culture? You don't have serious dating? Oh, you don't have casual dating. Okay. Well, the Navigator pattern has been where you basically start out serious. And used to be that at Glen Eyrie, if you got interested in somebody, I found this out a month ago, if you got interested in somebody and you got engaged, the first thing they did was ship you apart from each other. I look at that as horrendous. And because that has been our history, we tend to have the focus of going from friendship to serious without going through the foundation. And I've seen some of the marriages that have come out of that and the significant problems that are as a result. So the question is, yeah, you can go from here to here, but you're going to leave out something.
Could you substitute casual dating for the term healthy relationship?
Yeah, Yeah, now that's back to Ray's question. That's what I would say. Casual dating is more what we mean by healthy relationships, many healthy relationships. Okay. Some of them are healthy and some of them aren't. You know, I don't think I can answer that one in general. I'd say, yeah, that's probably the best way. That's one of the ways of doing it. You get a lot of casual relationships. If you use our casual our dating definition, you got a lot of these. Okay. Now, they may not be formal one-on-one, go off the Glen to go to a movie or go to dinner or something, but you got a lot of these happening. Gary? Yeah, Paula wants to say something.
Oh.
Do you want to answer that one?
No, I was really thinking back to something Greg had said. And what Ray is saying, I mean, you can skip that second part there. You can know a breadth of people and start right in with one. But you make it harder on yourself if you do that. And I think what Stacy's trying to say is there's something to be gained even in going out with a group of people, but in really taking active steps, really, to learn to communicate with opposite sex, just a little bit more than 5 minutes after lunch type thing. That there's something to be gained from that process. And what happens with what Greg is saying, I don't know if any of you have read what is now an ancient book, Walter Trobisch's I Married You. None of you. One. Few. Okay. That, you see, he explores marriage and dating from an African culture, and he draws a triangle. He says you can enter the triangle of marriage through three corners, through the physical or the sexual, the emotional, and the legal. In many other cultures of the world, they just enter through the legal side. They really didn't know each other very well, you know. Their parents thought it was a good idea or something. And after they got married then, I mean, you can make a marriage if you try hard enough, to about anybody work, you know, may not be that good. But after they got married then, in a legal sense, they learned to love each other. And there are a number of couples around the Navigators who essentially entered through that legal corner of the triangle and then woke up the next day and said, well, you know, I just don't feel a whole lot for you, you know. I mean, not that they said that, but they then had to learn what it was to love somebody. What Stacy's trying to point out here is the virtue of taking it slow and the virtue that there's something to be said for the process, I think.
Yes. And I would say back to Gary's question on small group and one-on-one, small group is generally right in here, group dating. You get serious, in the serious dating and engagement, you'll still have some group activities. I think that would be healthy. But you'll probably tend to go more one-on-one after you define the dating relationship as a serious relationship. All I want to do is to prevent some of the heartaches that are going to come. Now, maybe we haven't explained it very well. Take it by faith if we haven't. We want to prevent some of the heartaches that are going to come if you have the quantum leap approach to dating. There are easy ways to get into the quantum leap approach to dating. You're down here and all of a sudden somebody says, well, I love you. And if the other person accepts that, well, then all of a sudden you're up here. Okay? Yeah. I think I can do that with this next... Let's wait till we get to progression. We've got a lot of questions. We've got bunches of questions that are going to bring out those dangers, I believe. Okay? Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Then there's a lot of pressure on you when you're a defined couple. You really can't get to know each other very well when you're a defined couple, like you can in a uncommitted, casual type environment. Okay. Okay, another poor reason for not dating would be past hurts. Past hurts. Sure, we hurt. We all hurt for something in our past. Skeletons in our closets, the way Paula called it. That doesn't mean this new brother or sister that you're a friend with would be the same as this past relationship. Number six, they don't see the need. When we get into our communication section right after lunch, Lord willing, we want to educate the guys on how much they need women to learn how to communicate. And it's generally the guys that don't see the need. Last one you'll love. He said it's on the wrong list. And of course, I underlined the crucial problem on that one. Okay.
A lot of times that enters in on his rebound time. Like if he's just coming off of a serious relationship that he's broken off, I think it is important to not date for that reason. Just because if you're hurt emotionally, then you're more vulnerable to another person emotionally quicker.
Yeah, I agree. That's where you have a period of no relationships for one reason or another. Yeah, I think that's good. Maybe we should add that to the list, rebounding off of a deep relationship. That's a good reason. Okay, if you would open your books to page 46. Okay, I want you to discuss with your table group questions 3, 5, and 8. Questions 3, 5, and 8 on the questions for discussion. The question is, what are the marks of a healthy dating relationship? Brian. Okay, it's basically be prudent and wise rather than naive and dumb in your choice of locations. Johnny?
Your actual date should be well structured so you don't have the problem of, well, what should we do now?
Yeah.
Should have a definite plan.
The plans of the diligent lead surely to advantage, but everyone who wings it suffers harm. That's a, that's a Reinhardt paraphrase. That's a paraphrase of Proverbs 21:5, I believe. Plans of the diligent lead surely to advantage, but everyone who is hasty comes surely to poverty. This is the exact quote. Keith, you had something.
Yeah, I thought, but along with that, recognize that there's room for spontaneity. And just, if you don't have a plan, if you feel like picking up a snowball, throwing it at somebody, but you didn't think about it beforehand.
I would probably have planned it with a snowball in mind.
Yeah.
No, I just. Now, Paula would have avoided the snowball. Tried to. Okay, more marks of a healthy date. Marisi?
Be yourself.
Be yourself. Okay, excellent. Don't impress. You said have fun. In Christ, we have potential for real fun. Outside of Christ, no potential for fun. Now, the world defines fun as sin. And we know the end result of sin. Okay? Somebody else? Anything else? Right. Other-centered would be another way to say that. Okay, Deb, one more.
I was thinking when you said other-centered, I think, too, of including other people in the relationship. I mean, you can even have a serious relationship and still not be exclusive as far as...
That's an excellent point. A very good point. Okay.
The opposite sex. And certainly there... this is an irony to keep in mind. If you ask, I think that's sort of maybe one of our post-seminar type questions, but if you make a habit of interviewing casually couples who are Christians and have good marriages, you know, how did you get together? How did you know that God wanted you to marry this person? You'll find that comment come up indirectly over and over. You know, I didn't notice till later that, you know, I didn't pick up the... I wasn't attracted to this person's looks, not for a long time, even sometimes. And certainly, this situation of being at the Glen is probably the surest foundation that somebody, you know, could lay. It's the privilege of seeing somebody in a working and relaxed environment day in and day out. You can see what their personality is like and their character. It's a good thing. We want to talk for a minute about what it is that causes a relationship to progress. Both from two angles, you know. Some people have asked the questions, you know, how can I move to the next level? I want to see it go on. Or when you sense that the relationship is going too fast and you need to be able to throw the brakes on. These are at least five very significant factors of what causes a relationship to progress. Probably the biggest one is the time alone spent together. Like, there's a book that some of you I know have read, Too Close, Too Soon, where the guy's actually got it out in a graph, and he's averaged it out over couples where it generally takes about 300 hours together alone to get to the point of engagement or commitment to marriage. Well, you know, we haven't gone to the point of figuring out hours on it, but you can just count on the fact that is a big factor. And certainly in being interested in a relationship at the Glen, it's something that very early in the situation you've got to set some guidelines between the two of you and some standards on. Or it just runs away from you. You turn around and you see that person every where you go, so you know, you just spend another half an hour. Then the second thing, or another thing, would be conversation. And it's a very subtle thing. It's the use of pronouns. We, you and I. Especially in future tense verbs. You know, projecting into the future. Well, when you and I, or that's not the way we do, or it's just something you steer away from because it isn't we yet, and it isn't you and I. It isn't that until God makes that clear. Another thing is pressure from other people. Pressure from other people, that sense of really what Nancy mentioned, where you sense that from the group there's that effort to view you as a couple too soon. And it's not fair. It's something that should not be a part of relationships here. You ought to be able to say, well, I went out with George Friday night and nobody say anything, you know. Nobody makes a big deal of it, you know. Or, did you see so-and-so today? You know, and just that, or always sharing. Well, you know, I talked to Sam again, and this is what he said, and this is what I said. You know, it just goes on and on. It doesn't have to be that way.
Why do you do that?
Why do you do that?
Ego.
Ego, it makes you feel better to the security factor.
General
general sleepiness. Yeah, that's true. I mean, my goodness, this is a closed society almost here among us, and we know a lot of things about each other. But it's just a question for the sake of those people not talking about it. You place upon them a burden they can't bear. It's the pressure. You know, it keeps them from casually knowing each other. Debbie?
How do you, like if someone would say, how's it going with you guys? How can you answer that and still not fall pressure? You're not going to say it.
Well, I would have the tendency to first say, it's the wrong pronoun again. It's not us guys yet. You know, I just say something really, I'm enjoying getting to know so-and-so and drop it. And then I'm sure probably Stacy and I maybe even went too far, but we knew each other over a long and extended summer. And both of us realized by the end of that summer that something was beginning to happen there. But when I went back to school, and he went back to Texas, I was living with a girl. Her name was Pauline. We lived together for 4 years, and I casually mentioned to her that I had met a guy that I was sort of interested in that summer, and that if I ever married, I would like to marry somebody like him. And she knew I received cassette tapes from him in the mail, and she knew I saw him a day at Christmas. But to show you how little I told her about him, when we got engaged via telephone, that was about 12 o'clock at night. And I came back in and I woke her up and I said, "Paula, you are not going to believe this, but I'm getting married." And she sat straight up in the bed, fell straight back down again. And then she rolled over and she said, "And who, may I ask, are you marrying?" You know, she was being slightly facetious, but she was saying, I didn't realize, you know, that it had gotten to this point. And that may be a little far, I grant. But it speaks of the tremendous effort that Stacy and I felt before other people that we would not let ourselves think of this relationship further than what God had shown us. And we would not speak of it in terms that would make other people project for us something in the future. I remember telling my mother at Christmas that this guy was going to come through for a day, and she said, "Well, you know, this seems sort of suspicious to her. He's coming clear from Texas to Virginia." And I said, "Oh no, we're just good friends." But I knew that when she went out and bought prime ribs, she didn't pick that up. She never buys anything that isn't on sale. Chris?
I pretty much took the pace setter role in that, at least from the overview. But she, of course, took her own, made her own decisions with her roommate, which means she decided some things on her own.
I had spent a day with the Lord at the end of that summer that I felt like God had given me a verse out of Psalm 145 that said, "He will fulfill the desire of those who fear him." And I did not take that as meaning God was going to give Stacy in marriage. But I took that to mean that to fear God was to wait on him. And it just threw the brakes on. It threw him on in a big way for me.
In fact, let me add something here. There was a period of time where I made a unilateral decision to stop sending any cassettes. This was probably in October, November of that year. And I said, you know, it's too much on my mind, and I don't feel like I have objectivity with it. So I put on the brakes for about a month. Paul didn't like it at all.
It wasn't a very popular decision.
However, I look back on it and wouldn't have changed it a bit. I think I did the right thing for where I was emotionally. And I needed to get objective and put the whole thing back on the altar. Henry.
So you didn't have any friends take a picture of you as a couple or anything like that at all?
Mm-mm. Never a picture. that would have been permanent record right there. Not that kind of thing. And then the fourth, which is obvious, and of course not really an option to us, and that is physical involvement. It's a temptation, but not an option. It will immediately throw the relationship into sort of overdrive. It tends to not progress it. The verb is it catapults. Catapults it. And because especially to a woman, physical involvement generally implies commitment. And you know, I realize all of us are part of a generation where a couple meets and they go to bed together the first time they meet each other. That's the extreme of where we are, or certain within the first 2 or 3 months. And here we are on the other end of it, to the point where it sounds the height of prudishness, really, to suggest that you just forget about that. I mean, certainly about going to bed, but forget about the whole arena almost, until there's really a commitment towards something permanent. And I've gotten over my squeamishness, though, in my old age, personally suggesting that. I was thinking about the other day, I think the analogy to me would be that I wouldn't think of going to an art auction where I was going to invest my whole life savings drunk as a skunk or with the potential to get that way. We would just think that it was stupid. It just was illogical. But that's what happens in a relationship, because sensuality clouds the affection. It confuses the mind. And you never needed sobriety more than at that point. And I'm sure if we took a show of hands among this group, you've probably heard that kind of song and dance. Some of you, since you were in junior high, the church junior high group, you know, years. And there's a real temptation in that to feel that you know all about that, and that's sort of for weak people, you know. But me, I understand it all, and I'm strong. And I can proceed as it looks good to me. And that the root of it is pride, and it the end of it is a fall in some way. The fifth, then, is in a communication level, to openly say that you love someone, you need to be at a point where you are ready to say before God, follow that right after with, and I would like to marry you. The two of them go together. God doesn't, love from God's standpoint is always commitment. And it should be from our standpoint as a Christian. How many of you have seen the next to the last book that Ann Kimmel wrote? I haven't read it, but any of you remember the title? Yeah, I haven't read the book, but I love the title. I gave God time. And we want to talk for a minute about the virtues of giving God some time. You see, the temptation in a relationship is to feel, you know, this is bigger than the both of us. And it's meant to be, I just sort of go with the flow. It feels right. And it does feel right. It feels right if God's in a sense. And it's certainly better than anything I had in the past. I mean, if you've known some of the characters I've been out with type thing, you know, this is so far and away above it. And all those things may indeed be true. But we're trying to answer the unspoken question of what is it you benefit by giving God time. And we don't mean so much length of months, length of years, as we do a posture, a mental and emotional posture of waiting on God, of throwing the brakes on. And the things that come about from that is that it tends to have a purifying effect on both people, where it allows the waiting and the tension to press you to the Lord instead of, you know, before you develop intimacy between the two of you. That pressure and that tension presses you to the Lord, and it's a really, really healthy thing. Another thing is that it keeps you from running out ahead of God and then having to go through the pain of breaking off a relationship. It keeps you from centering your life prematurely on this relationship, da-da-da-da, you know. With any of God's gifts, the timing is as important as the gift. In the fullness of time, God sent his son. There was a time for it. And I was reading Isabel Kuhn's book this last week, In the Arena. How many of you have read that book? It's in the LDI library. It is an incredibly good book. If you want to see the practical, it's something about living overseas, but if you want to see the practicality of trusting God in the Word, I've never read a book its equal in that. But In the Arena by Isabel Kuhn, it's really almost a classic now in missionary literature. It's amazing the library has it. You can't get it in print, I don't believe. But anyway, she quotes a man as saying, in terms of waiting on God's timing, and she's talking about a different arena, but it applies. She uses the phrase, Satan rushes men, God leads them. And that is exactly what it is. You see, there's a paradox that God is working in your life at that point. If you wait on God, he will strengthen your desire for the other person. At the same time, he strengthens your willingness to relinquish the relationship if it's not his will. You see, that's why there's tension on the inside, because those two things are being developed at the same time. You would like them more. You're willing not to have it even more. You want so badly to do that, do what you do in the will of God. Now, on the other side of marriage, you see, looking from the long range and being able to look back. It's important that you really know that God brought you together. And especially if you hope to have a ministry, a ministering marriage, it's important that you know that God brought you together, because there will be greater tension there. And that you be able to look back on that. There's a verse in Deuteronomy 8, 16 and 17. It says, "In the wilderness he fed you with manna, which your fathers did not know, that he might humble you and that he might test you to do good for you in the end. Otherwise you might say in your heart, 'My power and the strength of my might have made me this wealth.'" In other words, the virtue of the wilderness period is that when God gives you the gift, you know who gave it. You know who gave it, and that God did it. You don't have to look back on it later in the dark days, and there are dark days in all relationships, and wonder if you manipulated it, if it was on your own ingenuity, so to speak. You are able then to look at your mate's deficiencies and see those as preordained by God. God built that in that other person. Or you're able to see the difference in his strengths and your strengths and say, yeah, there was a stronger union that God had in mind that he wanted to bring out of that. It's really important for a woman, because she needs to sense that God's calling on her husband is his calling on her. And if she can look back and see the way God brought that together, she didn't manipulate it, then she has peace, more peace about it. And then it helps you to see it as, if you can see it as God's gift, you don't clutch it so hard on the other side of marriage. For instance, I was just thinking the other day how funny when we took a college ministry in Stillwater. I bet you don't remember this one. He was getting ready to go away for a week or two. I remember it as being a long trip, and I was looking forward to the night just having time with him before he left. And lo and behold, his key guy shows up at the front door and just wants to come in and sit down and talk. And he knew Stacy was getting ready to go. I thought I would, privately have a stroke in the kitchen. But the the thing that came back to my mind that rescued me from real anger, really, was, it was just the reminder that Stacy was a gift. He was not mine. He was not my servant. And we don't make a habit of that kind of thing. But it freed me up. And the guy didn't stay that all that long. how many of you know Doug and Priscilla Sparks, or have seen them come through the Glen? That is Doug's second marriage. His first wife died in England. And we knew Priscilla real well. In fact, I had picked out Priscilla as the person that Stacy would marry. To tell you the honest truth, I looked over the arena and said, now that would be a good match. But anyway, they had a private wedding when they got married in Alabama, and everybody always said it was because Priscilla had played so many pranks on people that people would have come from all over the country to pay her back.
I would have been one.
This was the guy she fed the dog food to, if any of y'all have heard, and he ate the whole thing. And so
it was disguised in barbecue sauce on a nice-looking bun with pickles. I was real upset.
And when he picked it up, this is what I love. When she slipped and said, woof, woof, then he began to think, that was strange barbecue, I guess. But anyway.
Don't any of you get ideas.
Anyway, when they sent out a wedding announcement with their picture and his children. It was really a neat picture. And at the bottom of the picture was a verse from Isaiah, and this was all that was there. It said, "This is the Lord's doing, and it is marvelous in our eyes." And that verse has, I don't know where it is, that verse has so stuck with me. And you see, that is what God offers every one of you. The opportunity to be able to write that, so to speak, at the bottom of your picture, that you can know that God did it and that it was good in your eyes. Then the last section, and that is just the, if you read that book too close, too soon, he uses the phrase relationship counseling, and I really like that phrase. We just tend to think of the whole idea of counsel, but it falls under the category of why dating is not a private affair. You know, and we live in a culture where, my goodness, two consenting adults can do anything, basically. And no one is supposed to ask a question or offer advice or anything else. It's sort of, you know, it's my life and I'll live it as I want. But it's different in God's kingdom. And I just want to throw this out as a question. From what y'all have seen, so to speak, what would be the virtues of that phrase of relationship counseling?
Objectivity.
In other words, sort of the third party. Mark? Having it, relationship counseling.
Accountability.
Okay, Debbie?
Affirmation.
Yeah, somebody to encourage you.
Wisdom, because
age has to
do with what
you perceive,
you know,
beyond
people
that
have been
through life and beyond. Getting the
benefit
of somebody's hindsight.
Yeah,
Chris? What did you say? To know yourself. Right. And the irony of it is that there is probably no area that you need accountability in worse than that. And yet the temptation is so great to consider that as sort of, it just seems like it's something more private. It's a private thing between you and that person. So it's not the natural thing to open up to somebody or find somebody you can open up to and say, this is where we are, this is where she's come from, this is where I've come from. What do you think about, you know, the pace we're proceeding at, what's going on in my mind, what's going on in her mind, all that kind of hoopla? I think scripturally, it has its roots in the deceitfulness of the heart. There just isn't an area where your heart is more deceitful than in the area of relationships. Or like Hebrews 3:13 says, but encourage one another day after day, lest you be hardened by the deceitfulness of sin. I mean, let's face it, we just don't always see what's happening there. And then as I think Debbie said, later in darker days, you can look back on it and say, yeah, boy, it is wonderful to have the supportive memory of people who knew us both and encouraged us. Mike?
Are you talking about mentor type stuff? Are you talking about just like friends? Is it always...
Combination friend and mentor.
Is it always like an older couple kind of thing on this one, or is it just like somebody you're talking about your relationship with and they go, well, what about the same level? Is it a little bit just a friend?
Well, the responsibility of friends is to admonish one another. At the same time, so many times your friends will not really be hard on you. And I'm talking more of a mentor, spiritual counselor type. That would be the irreducible minimum of any type of input.
Mm-hmm. If it's a friend, it's got to be a really honest friend. And I just think scripturally, we see over and over again the principle that God's kingdom is run on interdependence. He doesn't bless lone rangers. Essentially, if you look at Israel's history, the absolute nadir of their history was in Judges 21:25, and it says, "And every man did what was right in his own eyes." The Old Testament phrase for, "I'll do it my way, thank you," in his own eyes. Well, certainly a lot of it has got to stem from fear that God might take it away, or might indicate that God wasn't in it. But that is a huge hurdle that you have to cross in any relationship where you are able to say, yeah, I realize if God doesn't have this in mind and it looks good to me, then He must have something so much better. And I'm not saying that counsel is inviolate. I think there's a wisdom in a breadth of counsel, certainly. But I think back to the couples that we have known, you know. I think back to the couples that we have counseled, that we have watched come together over 10 years. And I'm sure there's somebody who's gone against all the counsel that's ever given to them and been happy, but I don't know of one. I can't think of it. Because there's just a sense, certainly that does not deprive the couple of having to sit before God and say, what do you want? This is an indicator over here. This is a light on my dashboard. What do you want? But you just have to take the lights. I think that this attitude that Solomon exhibited when he was, you know, taking on the responsibility of the kingdom is a good one to bring out here. He said, this is what the way he prayed. When he looked at the situation, he said, boy, I can't discern what I ought to do. And he said, yet I am but a little child, and I do not know how to go in or come out. That's 1 Kings 3:7. And you see, with that attitude, God showed him, gave him incredible, incredible wisdom.
Okay, Fred?
Could you briefly mention the relationship between when you get the relationship counseling versus the depth of the relationship versus people focus?
That's a good question. At the point where either one of you, either one of those people senses that they could see something happen in the future and be very glad to see it happen that way, where mentally they're beginning to think that maybe God is in this, that's the point at which you begin to mention it to somebody and say, you know, I find myself really attracted to so-and-so.